This is a Scoop Audio interview with Ian Wishart, a man that puts out Investigate magazine and who has also been in the news this week. Ian, I noticed that Helen Clark referred to you as a creep yesterday. You found that astounding. Was it really astounding, though?
Well, it's a promotion from John Campbell being a little creep. Look, it is astounding in a sense of she's a prime minister and she should be acting professionally in the same way that we've got a job to do. And the media, a very big part of that job is or should be holding the executive to account. And the executive, by definition, is the party that is in power, the party that has the right to levy the taxes, the party that can introduce laws overnight that change the lives of its citizens.
I noticed that you did call Helen Clark a sickly archetypal nerd who now has the ability to kick sand in everyone else's faces in an interview. So you think, is it a bit fair to call you a creep? I mean, sickly archetypal nerd, does that equal creep?
I think the context of the Siege of Helengrad article, which is important here, given that it was stretched over about 10 pages, was a thesis on whether or not the worldview that you grow up with or that you develop as a teenager, when you carry it into the country's or the world's top job, for that matter, the same thing. I mean, the left pillories George Bush for his worldview, is relevant to how you do your job. And I think it is perfectly proper for the media to question the worldview of its leaders and how it impacts on the legislation they introduce, the way they think, the way they vote, the sort of powers they exercise.
Right, and I just wanted to pick up, you've actually worked in the Beehive, evidently, on the seventh floor. Who are you working for?
Mike Moore.
Oh, you're working for Mike Moore. So did you know Helen Clark and some of the other Labor heavyweights now then? Or?
I knew some of them. Helen Clark wasn't a Labor heavyweight at that stage. She was basically picking coffee beans in Nihirawa. But after I left, she became more of a player.
Okay. You state that you're giving it to Labor because they are the government. Is that entirely true?
Yeah, basically. If you look back at the period when National was in power, we published something like 40 to 45 books, and I wrote a number of them, about 10 or 11 of those. A lot of them dealt with political issues, and particularly the excesses of businessmen and politicians under National's rule. And, in fact, the second issue of Investigate in March 2000... carried a story on links between a Chinese spy and the Shipley administration that had invited him over. So, you know, at the stage when National was in power, we were darlings of the left. In fact, I was personally invited and urged by various activists and political parties to stand for the alliance. I was invited on more than one occasion to do that, even invited to put my name for selection for Labor. NZ First wanted to know if I would stand for them. The reality is that if you're doing your job as a journalist, you are going to annoy somebody some other time. And when you are holding the executive to account, which, as I said, by definition is the party in power, you're going to basically annoy them. So it's very easy for Helen Clark and indeed Labor supporters today to accuse me of being purely right-wing hating Labor. It's true, I disagree with a lot of the policies that they've introduced, in the sense of I think that they're knee-jerk policies designed to, cut the mustard with Labor voters and, you know, will expose weaknesses in those areas. But it's also true that we have investigated, and even during Labor's term, National's links to big business. But National aren't in power at the moment. I can't really hold them to account because it's not relevant.
Okay, well, what was relevant, and I found interesting, was after the House had risen, you did have an interview with Don Brash, and Murray McCully, where you ask questions like, has Labor's politically correct second term taken the party Icarus-like too close to the fire?
Well, it's a very valid question. I mean, one of the biggest criticisms of Labor, certainly if you listen to the mood of the public, and this would be demonstrated by the very close election result, was that Labor had become too politically correct. And what I was asking National is, do they believe that Labor's social engineering in its second term played a role, a major role, in ticking people off?
You certainly got screeds of an answer there from Mr. McCully. You also asked this presumably rhetorical question, can the former Reserve Bank governor steer us towards the good times again? Which good times were they?
Well, any good times.
were we not in a good time when you asked
in the sense of economically, I think that was the context, because I don't have the article in front of me. But I think that would be speaking towards a New Zealand boom, because the reality is, as we're now experiencing, at the time of the election, New Zealand was starting to track downwards economically. And, you know, the results of the last few months have indeed borne that out. So the question was, could National, given the set of circumstances that it's inheriting, you know, soften that landing or turn it around?
So it wasn't, could Don Brass steer us back to the mid-90s with high unemployment?
No. It wasn't drawing that analogy. I was really sort of looking at the short to medium term in front of the country once the election was over.
Do you try and bring an ethical or Christian stance to Investigate magazine?
Investigate is published by Christians, and we have one Christian column in it. The magazine, however, is a current affairs magazine. It's primarily, I mean, most of the content would have nothing to do with beliefs. However, as I was explaining to somebody yesterday, all of us as journalists, whether one is left-wing or right-wing, whether one is a skeptic, an atheist, a Christian, a Buddhist, we all bring to the task our own perspective of the world, and therefore you will get journalists who are more attuned perhaps to the left-wing, who will take a harder look at right-wing parties, and vice versa, journalists who are more right-wing who will take a harder look at left-wing parties, and they may not even realise that those are the unconscious biases they bring to it, and it can go not just politically, it can go socially as well. For example, social conservatism. Now, I am a social conservative, no secret of that, and yes, of course, I own the magazine, and that can colour the sort of stories that I might cover or decide to cover once in a while. I might decide that everybody else is taking a very politically correct view of an issue, and I might decide that there hasn't been enough balanced coverage towards the other side of the coin. So I'll publish an article exploring the converse side of the argument.
I'd ask that, when allegations are made against people, do those people always have a chance to reply to them, though?
It depends on what's involved. If I have a case that is what I would call a slam dunk legal, the ultimate test of Investigate is in the courtroom. We have a policy at this magazine and have done since the year dot that any story we do has to be defendable in court for defamation purposes, because every story that we do potentially carries that risk. Now, when you are dealing with issues like David Parker, for example, that was a legal slam dunk. On the facts alone, his opinion was irrelevant. I covered as much of his opinion as I could in the article in terms of his testimony to the official assignee. But I'm limited to some extent. I'm not like Scoop, and I'm not like the Herald, and I'm not like the Dominion Post or TV3 in the sense of I have a publishing deadline every day or every hour. Investigate has, in the past, gone to key government agencies and figures on some sensitive stories, and we have been injuncted or attempted to be injuncted, and has cost enormous amounts of money purely because there's such a lead time between when we're working on a story and when it actually comes out. So after a few of those attempts and a few non-returned phone calls from the Labor government anyway, when we've approached them asking for comment, we thought, well, okay, if they're not going to play ball, we will simply just do our job, make sure we can defend it in court, and there we go.
Okay, I just say that because you yourself have taken a Broadcasting Standards Authority complaint regarding agenda, and you complained that the item was imbalanced because you didn't have the opportunity to respond to
comment. No, what I had an issue with agenda was Simon Pound lying like a flatfish. You see, what happened is he arranged to interview me about the Tamariri story, and he said to me expressly that he had not spoken to anybody at the cafe and that management didn't want anyone at the cafe to be spoken to because that they felt they were being dragged into this disagreement between John Tamariri and myself, and so they wouldn't be doing that. Because I said to him, you know, have you spoken to anyone here and asked them what they saw or you know, et cetera, and he expressly said no. Now, unbeknownst to me, Simon Pound had secretly recorded cafe staff, and further than that, John Tamariri, or those associated with him, had provided Simon Pound with secret tape recordings they'd made. So Simon Pound went into his interview with me in a complete ambush mode, but never actually ambushing me on the spot. If he had the information, he had me there, he could have put those allegations to me. He chose not to, and although the overall item I had no problem with because the panel discussion, saw through Simon Pound's ignorance probably, but Simon Pound himself had a bias against Investigate, possibly because of his own orientation, possibly because of his politics.
But you don't think you ambushed David Parker then?
Not at all. I didn't have David Parker in front of me for an interview where I could put those allegations to him. And it was a clear legal slam dunk. Now, Simon Pound's piece was not accurate. It was purely a setup. And so there's the difference. I felt that Simon Pound had used up any journalistic credibility he still had.
I guess just for the record, that complaint wasn't upheld by the BSA.
No, it wasn't upheld for the obvious reasons, but as far as they were concerned, that the overall panel discussion cleared it up. But if I'd chosen to sue Simon Pound, I could have.
Okay. What is your relationship with John Tamaheri like these days?
Oh, we do lunch regularly. I haven't spoken to John since the item came out.
But you do believe when you were chatting to him that everything he was telling you about life at the Beehive was the truth?
Well, I was having an interview with him. It didn't matter, what I was going to go through and double-check in terms of accuracy. He's a former cabinet minister looking to get back into cabinet. He's giving us an interview, which we'd asked him for. He's sitting there posing for photographs, which, he knew were for the front cover of the magazine. Spelt out his views on life, the universe and everything. So, I'm not quite sure the point of your question.
Well, I'm just saying, you seem to believe that he was telling the truth about the Beehive, but yet after the interview, obviously getting back to the Simon Pound thing, he was denying that there was a recorder on the table, so I'm wondering...
I'll tell you why. Because John Tamaheri, in between, this again comes back to the lead time of magazines, in between the time when we did the interview, he then, the following Wednesday... stood up in Parliament and gave Duncan Garner from TV3 a right going over a stream of consciousness. And he'd actually told me that he was planning to do that at the interview. But the end result of it was that he, from reading the news reports after the whole Tamaheri thing blew up, he actually got called up to Helen Clark's office and was given a please explain, why the heck did you shoot your mouth off? And during the course of that discussion, it appears that he's confessed to Helen that he's spoken to Investigate magazine. But he has assured her, to her face, that it was an off-the-record discussion and the two guys were, quote, just kicking a ball around. Now, for him to admit that there was a tape device on the table, for him to admit that the interview was on the record, would be, at that point in time, remember the context that happened then, would be for him to admit to Helen Clark, I've just lied to you. And that would destroy him anyway. He held on to whatever slim hope he had of getting through it, and he couldn't resile from the corner that he painted himself into. So that's why he lied like a flatfish.
So he lied like a flatfish after the interview, but beforehand everything was the God's honest truth.
Well, different circumstances came to bear. Before the interview, his career wasn't on the line. After the interview, and after he'd blown up Duncan Garner, and after he told Helen Clark a different version of events, but before the interview came out, he then faced a crystallisation of all his worst nightmares. So I don't think you can compare the two events and say, well, he tells the truth in an interview and then somehow he lies afterwards without taking the context into account. He was saving his skin at that stage.
Okay, well, just one other thing about John Tamaheri. He was stating, that he was a guy in the know and that the election was going to come in June. Was he really in the know, considering the election came in September?
Well, how would you and I know? I mean, the reality is that a number of MPs told us that interview with John Tamaheri probably was the sole reason an early election was delayed. Again, we're crystal ball gazing there, and there's no way of proving it one way or the other.
Okay, we'll move on to... I'll just wrap it up. Some journalists work closely with politicians. You work closely with Winston Peters over the wine box.
Yep.
Do you still work closely with politicians on stories?
No, not generally. Politicians, certainly I've had a fair share of phone calls from politicians in the wake of the David Parker and David Benson Pope cases, usually to say, bloody good job. But I was saying to somebody else the other day, our story tips don't come from politicians and we're not connected to Wellington per se. The David Parker case, Russell Hislop came to us on the basis of what we'd done on David Benson Pope, and you'll remember that the David Benson Pope stuff we'd done, and again, here's a perfect example of left-wing journalists muddying the waters. Russell Brown on TV the other day sits there and pokes at me and says, all this had been reported before about David Benson Pope. What a load of absolute bollocks. The report, the police report, contained information that had not been published by the media because it was 1,000 pages long and the media hadn't read it in full. So the information about schoolgirls and nighties being made to stand outside and bullying of a teacher and so forth, it was all fresh information. Now, as a result of publishing that fresh information, other students came forward. Am I supposed to ignore their claims of a news story? Of course I'm not. It's my job as a journalist to get there. David Benson Pope was an absolutely fair target. Investigate did its job. Why the rest of the media weren't there, Lord knows.
Right, but you didn't work on the Benson Pope or the Parker stories with Rodney Hyde at all, as has been alleged by Helen Clark.
This is the vast left-wing conspiracy theory.
Yeah,
it's interesting how the left wing paint the vast right wing conspiracy. You join the dots and you paint up everything from the Mont Pelerin Society down to Ian Wishart and Investigate and everyone else. And yet the left is the quickest to look at the conspiracy theories and blow them out of proportion. Look at the Exclusive Brethren. You know, the left wing of the media were all over that like an absolute rash, as if it was the worst, horriblest thing to possibly have come out of the election campaign. And yet they did nothing on Doongate, and they did nothing on the background of Owen Glenn. You know, where were the great stars of left-wing journalism looking at the background of Labor's biggest campaign donor, who turns out to have been prosecuted for fraud in the US, and a director of whose New Zealand operations is implicated in one of the world's largest money laundering scandals in the Caribbean, and it turns out that Owen Glenn is the tobacco freight handling agent for British American Tobacco. Ironic that Labor's biggest campaign donations came from basically Smokey. So, you know, where was the great left-wing investigative journalism? It didn't exist. Instead, they were rubbishing the National Party, rubbishing the right wing, and painting this great conspiracy theory involving a couple of fusty old Exclusive Brethren types.
Well, fusty old Exclusive Brethren types and $500,000 and...
Well, yeah, but what about the tobacco baron bailing out Helen Clark? Where was Scoop on that?
Well, I don't know. We're probably busy putting up press releases from National
and possibly. But, I mean, you take my point. So, yeah, my response to Helen Clark and others is get a life. If I spent my, you know, if I was working in Wellington...
Just for clarity, though, that's a no, you haven't worked with Rodney Hyde on this.
No, I said to you before, I get phone calls after the event, but I'm certainly not working with anybody. You know, we are a standalone magazine, and we maintain an arm's length relationship with... politicians and anybody else for that matter, because for precisely the reason that one day we might have to investigate these people. And that's been the way that I've approached my career all the way through. Now, I'll grant you, I worked closely with Winston Peters on the Wine Box, and that would force me to declare a conflict of interest if I was ever to have to really meaningfully investigate Winston Peters in a negative sense, because I count Winston Peters, although I don't socialise with him, I count him as a friend. But that is a conflict of interest I would declare. I try not to form friendships with politicians for precisely this reason, however, because it would make it harder for me to do my job down the track. So as a rule, I don't work with politicians.
Your magazine was hinting that Labor was going to go off on a crazy social engineering sort of bent following the election. Do you think Winston Peters and New Zealand First have actually stopped that?
Yeah, the New Zealand First caucus, even what remains of it, is still more conservative than the Labor administration, and the United Future certainly is, and the Māori Party caucus is socially conservative as well. So the election result has pretty much by and large clipped the wings of Labor in terms of any prospective social engineering legislation that they wanted to complete. You've got to remember, Labor doesn't get third terms as a rule, so this was the last chance, if you like, to really stamp their mark on it. Now, they haven't got that chance. There might be some things that'll get tweaked, but there's not going to be anything significant, I would suggest, getting passed.
Okay, and the last question, Ian. You've got Tamihere, you've got Benson Pope, sort of, and, of course, Parker. Who's next? Should Shane Jones be... Should his knees be knocking? He's a Maori, he's been a prominent businessman...
You know, the person who ends up on the front cover of the next few Investigates, even I don't know who they are yet. I said to, I think it was National Radio, I'm not actively sitting up there with a list of Helen's cabinet working my way through them. Having said that, you know, it looks like it could be quite fruitful as an investigative journalism exercise. But there are other stories around, and I, you know, I don't want to dwell all the time on politics, and you know, we've done three political issues in a row. So, you know, maybe it's time for a breather. Heck, I need it as much as anyone else.
Okay, thank you very much for your time there, Ian.
No worries.